This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. On the local news roundup today, we're taking a look at a violent Memorial Day weekend that pushed the homicide rate 89% above the first 5 months of 2016. We also have updates on budget season in both Raleigh and Mecklenburg County. And our panel might be kicking around some thoughts on a publicly funded soccer stadium. Speaking of that panel, on the roundup today, we have Ann Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer, Nick Oxner from WBTV, David Borax from WFAE, and Sean Flynn from Spectrum News. Welcome to you all.
Good morning.
Great to be here. I see what you did there with that intro there.
What did I do?
Kicking around. We're kicking around.
You see? See? Yeah. I worked on that for months.
It's way too early in the morning for puns that bad.
Oh, it's never too early for puns. Before we get into some of those topics, let's start with the story that broke yesterday, the widely expected decision by President Trump to leave the Paris Climate Accords. I want to talk a little bit about the local reaction. Congressman Robert Pittenger issued a statement yesterday saying, quote, President Trump knows a good deal from a bad deal. The Paris Climate Accord would have had an onerous impact on our economy. This agreement was additional evidence that President Obama was president of the world, not president of the United States, end quote. You're going to be shocked, but Jennifer Roberts, the mayor of Charlotte, has a different opinion. She says, quote, I am deeply disappointed in President Trump's decision to exit the Paris Agreement, but Charlotte is no less determined to do our part to combat climate change. I have joined 68 mayors from across the country in committing to adopt, honor, and uphold the commitments to the goals enshrined in the Paris Agreement. So, what difference does this make locally, this move by President Trump, which obviously has all these international ripples, but what difference does it make locally, David?
Well, you know, Jennifer Roberts referred to the agreements, the commitments made by mayors around the country, and I think we should think about that and all the companies around the country that have made commitments to do this already. I think the fight against climate change has a head of steam right now already. So many companies have already talked about how they're going to work towards more sustainable policies, and the electric utilities as well. Duke Energy being a case in point, you know, every year they put out a sustainability report with projections for how they're going to do, and they have set some pretty high bars for themselves for converting to more gas, which is less polluting than coal, and also using more renewable energy. And so I think, you know, those things are going to keep happening whether the U.S. is in the climate agreement or not. Likewise, with many of the big corporations around here, they're looking at ways that they can help to cut their to reduce their carbon footprints.
And so, you know, most of what we're hearing from experts is that people like Duke Energy are not really going to change their policies and their strategies because of what Donald Trump has done. So I think from a local standpoint, it doesn't look like there's going to be a whole big change in business, right?
No. And in fact, really interestingly, this morning, the New York Times is reporting that there's an effort afoot amongst like 30 different cities, three governors, and like 100 private businesses and they're in talks apparently with the UN to still be a party to the UN, to the Paris Climate Agreement, and still hit those targets. Michael Bloomberg has pledged to pay for this new effort. So it's entirely possible that this group of people like Jennifer Roberts, Roy Cooper came out and also, you know, said he's going to try to make North Carolina, you know, still be environmentally friendly. But when you have those people, it looks like they're going to try to pick up the torch that was dropped by very ceremoniously yesterday Donald Trump and still try to hit these targets.
Sean Flynn?
Well, even 2 minutes into President Trump's speech talking about the withdrawal, you already had President Barack Obama sending out his news release saying he's disappointed, but now it is up to the cities and the states and the county leaders to move forward with this. And I believe now, as of we're recording this, or live now, there's 82 mayors who have signed that agreement to continue on with the plan. The thing I find fascinating, and I don't mean to kind of almost shift topics here, but you can't have any topic anymore that goes on in the world without it impacting this Charlotte mayoral race.
That's a good point.
Within minutes of this, you had Senator Joel Ford talking about how the Charlotte City Council needs to have a resolution to take up climate change. And then moments later, you had Mayor Roberts have a bit of a tweet storm talking about all the things that she's done. You had her campaign manager firing off on Joel Ford. I mean, it just
Vi Lyles tweeted too, not to be left out.
Of course, she absolutely did. So it's just fascinating. There's not a topic that happens anywhere in the world that does not impact the Charlotte mayoral
race.
That's
true. We'll have to scramble and find Kenny Smith's thought on this as well. I have not seen that yet. He may have already tweeted. Speaking of the president, we had another week of questions, obviously, about possible ties between the administration and Russia. And David Borex, you had an interview with U.S. Senator Tom Tillis and asked him a little bit about those connections. Here's what he had to say.
We'll get back to the...
I don't know that there's any evidence that Russia played a role in getting him elected, but there's plenty of evidence suggesting that they're intervening in elections in the United States, in France, and other parts of the world. They've done it for years. They're just more sophisticated now, and it is something that we have to hold Russia accountable for. But to go so far as to say they actually affected the outcome of the election, I don't see any evidence to substantiate that. It makes great headlines, but there's no real evidence behind it.
So, David, one of the things I wondered about as he was speaking on Russia is what sense, if any, you got of how much Tillis may or may not be aligned with the other North Carolina senator, Richard Burr, who, of course, is the head of the Senate Intelligence Committee.
Well, I think probably closer to Burr than to Donald Trump on many issues. You know, many people know Tillis as the guy who helped lead the Republican takeover in the General Assembly back in 2011, 2012. But, you know, remember, the Senate seat is elected statewide. And at this point, Democrats still outnumber Republicans statewide. So he really came off in that interview as a moderate and as a pragmatist, which was a bit of a surprise.
And did you get a chance to ask him about the episode at the marathon? What was it? Was it 5K?
It was a 5K race in Washington a few weeks ago, and he collapsed about two and a half miles into the race. And so there were a lot of stories right afterwards that the people were doing CPR on him, that he had some kind of cardiac incident, and he did post a tweet or two tweets afterwards showing himself to be healthy. And so we asked him about that, and he said, you know, I think that it just got blown out a little bit. Yes, some people were doing chest compressions on him, but he said his heart was still beating, and he was worried that he had bruised ribs afterwards.
Please stop. Please stop.
Exactly. But, you know, he said he was out running again the next day, and that his big fault was that he didn't hydrate enough. So it seems like it's not any long-term damage there.
My favorite quote from him, Senator Tillis, on that one is he ran a great 2.5-mile race. Unfortunately, it was 3 miles.
Sean, I'm going to pick up on what you said earlier, which is turning to a much more serious topic. Anything can be connected to the mayor's race, and certainly this issue, which is the continuing surge in violent crime. There were 4 more homicides over the Memorial Day weekend. Let's first hear from CMPD Captain Cecil Brisbane talking about that.
It's been a while since we've seen a weekend that had this many senseless acts, and quite frankly, it's disturbing to us as any one homicide is.
So let's start with the public safety part, and then we'll get into the political part. Nick, what are the police trying to do here? Obviously, they're trying to reduce the level of crime, but do they have any kind of theory or strategy on how to slow this wave down?
Well, and this is obviously not a new problem just this weekend, right? This is just a reminder this weekend of
36 homicides this year.
That's right. I mean, super on pace to really have the deadliest year that Charlotte's seen in a long time, if not ever. And police have said that a lot of this looks like people who just can't solve problems other than shooting at each other. And so it almost appears as though police are somewhat stumped on really how to prevent this. Also, you know, the rise in violence has made a great case for Chief Putney to push for more personnel. We know he's been asking for more police officers for years. And so I think this is a case where I think if you're the chief, you say, look, if we had more bodies on the street, we could help prevent some of this.
Well, and of course, this budget that is going to be approved June 12th has another 62 officers. That'll be 125 in 2 years. So one of the obvious questions here is, do they have enough? Will 125 be enough over a couple of years to really make a dent in this?
I mean, I don't know if there is a number that is enough to actually address a homicide rate like this. I think you have to address the overall issues that are causing people to turn to guns instead of, you know, talking it out.
This is not just a police problem.
This is not just a police problem. I mean, look how many police officers they have in Chicago. And this past weekend, I mean, they would love to have a weekend with just 4 people killed.
And in a lot of cases, there have been arrests fairly quickly after the violence happens. So it doesn't appear to be the kind of thing where there's a gang out marauding, and if we could just stop the Bloods or the Crips, you know, this violence would go away. This is, again, apparently episodic, one-on-one, somebody takes a gun, and then you're kind of cleaning up the mess after that.
It is still primarily people who know each other, or a lot of them are people who know each other. And, you know, we are at double last year's rate, and they are solving about three quarters of them. But solving a murder after the fact is no solace for the people who've lost a loved one.
And we were talking about how we are seeing some things. This is not Chicago, but we're seeing things that don't feel like Charlotte. When you have police responding to a report of a shooting and there's gunfire as they arrive. And I think Nick said his wife was actually out there ducking behind a car to broadcast from that. Or when you have
the convention center episode on Thursday morning,
are sexually assaulted and robbed at gunpoint, you know, while they're coming back from a night on the town. Again, I've worked uptown for 25 years. I walk to and from my car in a parking lot that's not terribly close by. I don't feel like I'm in danger, but you know, you see this kind of thing, and especially if you're potentially an out-of-town visitor coming to Charlotte, you're thinking, ooh, is that a place I want to be?
Well, even the officer yesterday, when doing a news conference on the sexual assault armed robbery attack in uptown, said he'd never seen anything like that in his couple of decades, and calling it a heinous crime. I mean, that's just shocking to people, that crime specifically.
Well, and they pretty promptly arrested a 19-year-old who has already a long criminal history, had just recently gotten out of prison, apparently homeless, according to our story, may have had a history with mental health issues. So on one hand, that sounds like, you know, again, just kind of a really bad episode by a person who has a lot of problems, although I think we want to follow it because that's also sometimes the kind of person who can get scooped up when you want to solve a crime really quickly. You know, a homeless 19-year-old who's, you know, we just don't have a real sense of why he did this or, you know, why this thing came about.
Now, flipping to the political side, if you're an incumbent mayor in an election year, how big of a problem do you face with this going on?
It certainly doesn't help, right? Especially when you have, if you're Jennifer Roberts and you've got Vi Lyles and Joel Ford coming at you in the primary, you've got Kenny Smith in the general election, that ready to face off against any three of those. You know, I think that Joel Ford and Vi Lyles are both trying to outflank Jennifer Roberts from different sides of who's going to be the safety. You know, Joel Ford has the plan to reduce crime and support the police, and Vi Lyles has a plan to engage the community and try to solve this from that angle. But both of them have plans that are kind of squeezing Jennifer Roberts into the middle, you know, in between both of them, I think, and certainly a tough spot.
Yeah, I mean, what did you think of the reaction this week? Not only Vi Lyles and Joel Ford, but also Kenny Smith saying that, you know, public safety would be his number one priority. I know that's not, you know, earth-shattering type statement during a mayoral campaign, but, you know, that kind of thing does resonate when you have crime up to this degree in an election year.
I mean, crime is always a good topic if you're running for office. You know, if you can say the right things about it and convince people that you're the one to solve the problem if there's any solution out there. I do think it's disappointing to see it take a shift this way if in fact that's what's happening, because we, as we talked about a minute ago, there are underlying problems in Charlotte that are contributing to this. You know, we just had the Opportunity Task Force report last month that talked about how Charlotte remains one of the most difficult cities to rise the economic ladder. And those kinds of issues are a lot more difficult to solve and a lot more difficult to talk about.
Well, and I think that's the interesting difference as we talk about, you know, someone like Joel Ford's crime plan, right? And you look at Vi Lyles attacking it more from, you know, the picking up where the Opportunity Task Force left off. And I think those two approaches are leaving not a lot of room for someone like Jennifer Roberts to come in and say, this is how I'm going to keep addressing the issue.
We do have a little bit of better news coming up in our next segment. We're going to take a break here in a moment, but we're going to talk about how your tax bill should be status quo as we get into budget season. You're listening to the Weekly News Roundup here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE, and I'm Eric Sandberg in for Mike Collins.
We'll get back to the local news roundup in a moment here on Charlotte Talks. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Sanger Heart and Vascular Institute, part of Carolina's healthcare system, offering comprehensive heart care, including the region's only minimally invasive heart bypass option and heart transplant center. Support also comes from Steinway Piano Gallery, presenting Steinway Comes to Davidson, a factory selection event at Davidson College featuring new and pre-owned Steinway-designed pianos. Friday through Sunday, information at pgch.com.
President Trump makes good on a campaign promise to pull the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Agreement. That historic accord set goals to limit greenhouse gas emissions in order to curb the rise of global temperatures. The president says it's a bad deal for American workers, but critics see this as a bad move for the environment. A look at what the pullout means when Charlotte Talks, Monday morning at 9, on 90.7 WFAE.
I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Coming up on the next On Point, Jared Kushner's Kremlin back channel, White House shakeups, a deadly bombing in Kabul. Our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
The news roundup continues following Charlotte Talks with On Point from 10 to noon. Here on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
We're back on Charlotte Talks with the news roundup. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. On our panel today, we have Ann Doss-Helms from the Charlotte Observer, Nick Oxner from WBTV. Still on your side, right, Nick?
Last I checked.
Okay, very good. Sean Flynn from Spectrum News and WFAE's David Borax. So I promised some good news, but first we're going to talk about the state legislature.
Oh, never good news.
Wow.
Just
Eric.
Kidding. Come on. I'm just kidding.
Zinger.
Just kidding. Nick, I know you find the Soviet-style architecture of the legislative building in Raleigh to be an inspiration for you, so let's start with you. Some details on the House budget came out this week. What did they do in comparison to what the Senate has done?
Well, they passed the budget technically this morning at like 12:30 this morning. The House did. The Senate had already passed theirs, and so naturally the two really don't meet all that much. And the House takes an approach of being a little more moderate in how we spend money compared to the Senate's pretty conservative, you know, keeping a lot of money in the bank, cutting down on spending. But both budgets include decreases actually in the amount of taxes, some tax relief for people. They both include more money for teachers. They include in some way, shape, or form money for state retirees. So those are some of the kind of big top level line items.
And the big thing with the taxes seemed to be, I think the Senate was cutting personal income taxes and the House was approaching it more from deductions. There were some deduction changes in the Senate, but there were more of them in the House.
That's exactly right. And so those are that's the big difference when we talk about the Senate always wants to take the more conservative approach to budgeting or to tax policy. And then you have the folks in the House, which of course is a bigger caucus with a wider range of people. And so now the two bodies are going to come together in a conference and try to iron out their differences.
But the one thing that the House members all seemed to agree on yesterday afternoon was that ice cream break.
Yes, that's true.
Well, I can't argue with that. It was
a 13-hour marathon right in the middle of it. You get a whole bunch of ice cream coming in.
We finally found what unites our country.
That's right.
It's cream.
The interesting thing here is that there is going to be some fundamental changes in tax policy. Because if you recall 2 years ago in 15, when in the last biennium budget year, the session stretched to like September.
Right.
That's because the two sides couldn't agree on tax policy. In fact, the House was angry that the Senate was trying to ram through some tax policy in the budget, and that's what kept them there to September as they dickered over whether or not they were going to have major tax changes. But what's for sure now is that there's going to be some new major tax overhauls here vis-a-vis the budget, and also they should be done by the end of June.
Well, which would be
knocking on wood,
a grand improvement. Governor Cooper, following up on what Democrats have largely complained about, which is the idea that taxes have been cut enough and there needs to be more investment in education, particularly in terms of support staff, not just teachers. He also has some larger pay raises for teachers. That's a long way of me asking, his whole strategy has been to rally public support to make enough noise so that Republicans might listen. What do you think the chances are that Republicans might listen?
None. I mean, zero. Well, they might listen long enough to tell them no. Governor Cooper wants more money for teachers. Also, I think he's made some more noise on behalf of other state employees who have been raising their hands in the back of the chamber, kind of saying, hey, guys, what about us as the teachers get, I think the House budget has like a 9% raise for mm-hmm. teachers. And other state employees across the board are like, hey, us too. And so that's also been a point of contention.
Well, I'm just going to add on to Governor Cooper says he wants 10% for teacher pay raises, and both of the House and Senate are around 9.5%. So we're
in the ballpark, right?
Right, in the same ballpark here.
Yeah.
And state employees would get this $1,000 raise, I guess, across the board. And there's money in there for retirees as well, a 1.6% raise. So there is something for other state employees, but as you say, probably not what they were hoping for.
Trust me, they're disappointed.
Yeah. Well, the retiree piece in particular, because I think it's 1.6% on the House side. There's not one in the Senate budget. But the retirees have called for 2% on an annual basis, which seems to be a very long shot.
And never going to happen. Yeah, they wanted a COLA, a cost of living increase, in the last year's budget, and they didn't get that. And so when you have – this is where we go to conference, and you know, if it's in one budget, not the other, they come together and they kind of work that out. So I would be willing – and both sides pass the most extreme versions, basically, of what they want to do, right? And so maybe they'll be lucky if they can get a 1% increase out of the Senate.
Back to your question about whether the Republicans will listen to the Democrats – the negotiation here is between the House and the Senate and different kinds of Republicans, not with Democrats.
And the other difference, you remember in 15 and last year where we had Republicans kind of fighting with themselves because then it went to the Republican governor,
right,
who then kind of was fighting with them too. But, you know, here and we've heard this all year, you know, that the legislature has been in session, that the Republicans are trying to present a much more united front. They're doing their bickering in the back room out of the public's eyes instead of more publicly like they had been doing. Because here in the House and the Senate, they are all kind of uniformly saying that, look, it's going to be us versus Governor Cooper, the Democrat, instead of, you know, just the Republican family fight that we've been seeing.
And so in some ways, it's almost a cleaner transaction. They were all supporting Pat McCrory, but when you have a Democratic governor, it's much easier to unite within your caucuses in the chambers. And
the battle lines are more clearly drawn.
Speaking of battle lines, we are also in budget season for Mecklenburg County, and that always means that CMS and the county are trying to do business together. So this week, Dina DiOrio, the county manager, made her recommendations, including cutting nearly half of the school system's request for additional money. Here's part of her explanation.
This will support the cost of opening new facilities, cost increases for health and retirement benefits, sustaining operations, and a portion of the request to expand student services to include guidance counselors and social workers.
So she recommended $15 million in change. I think the school system had asked for $27 million more. Jim Puckett, who is Republican vice chair of the board, seemed more than comfortable with taking an axe to what the school system had requested.
Yes, they got less than they asked for. They could not make the case to me, and I think to other commissioners, that their ask was relevant or even well thought out.
So, Andos Helms, how is this going over at CMS in terms of recovering some of what might be lost?
From what I can tell, they've been fairly quiet. In fact, what they seem happy about is the other part of this presentation from Dina DiOrio, in which she recommended putting the full $937 million bond package on the agenda in November, which is going to be a whole different thing that we can talk about. But with the operating budget, for better or for worse, this has become part of the annual dance. It's sort of like a Middle Eastern bazaar or the American health insurance system, where you ask for a much bigger amount than you expect to get. They never present it that way. What Ann Clark had said was that the only part of that was not absolutely needed to cover rising costs and or growing enrollment was the $4.5 million for additional support services, workers, counselors, social workers, et cetera. So, and there's also apparently looking to have about $6 million in there that will cover some of the costs of the new student assignment plan that they're going to have to work up to for 2018. So if all of that is literally true, then CMS is going to be in quite a pinch. But they always seem to find it, and there are still big variables. This whole thing about the state raises, there are people within CMS, the majority of CMS employees are state employees, but many of them are also paid through county money. So a bigger raise for state employees means there is a bigger chunk of county money needed to make sure that those employees, so it's like a good news, bad news, you know, good news for the employees, but less discretionary money out there for this task that will actually be handed off to Clayton Wilcox when he takes over on
July
1st. Yeah.
Welcome.
Flaming bag of...
Well, this is my 14th budget cycle that I've observed, and it seems like, you're exactly right, that every year CMS asks for a number. The county manager comes back with a number somewhere around this, you know, half, maybe a little bit more than half. And then the board will normally find a couple extra million to throw in saying, hey, look what we did. We went above and beyond what the county manager did. But I actually feel a little bad for the budget policy directors at CMS because they're the ones who have to come up with their budget first. Then they have to find out what the county does. Then they have to find out what the state does. And then they have to redo all their budget again. So it's pretty much like, hey, I'm going to budget my family this year, or vacations, everything else like that. But I have absolutely no idea how much money I'm going to have.
And
coming
you know, well, the school year is going to start in August, regardless of whether the legislature has finished its business or they got the budget they wanted or not.
Or like 2 years ago when it lasted through September. Yeah. So you really have no idea.
And we've talked about this on shows like this for years and years and years, and yet nothing changes with the budgeting system for schools.
Eric Spanberg for governor.
Well, and you could argue that for all the rhetoric every year
make
about
Mecklenburg great again.
You know, this is horrible and it's going to fall apart and the schools are in danger. Things seem to operate fairly smoothly. So that's potentially some of the drama may be something that's just baked into the system now.
So the county budget that was recommended is $1.7 billion in operating and then $1.6 billion in capital. And more than half of that, of course, is coming from the school bond. So we've touched on this before, but Anne, given what's going on with the student reassignment, with some of this discussion with the Mecklenburg commissioners, what odds do you give this school bond?
Well,
and is it 937? Is that the number that emerges, you think?
I think that probably, well, it'll be interesting. There are a lot of factors at play here, and they're sort of contradictory in that during the whole student reassignment debate, there was a lot of talk about if I don't get my way, the bonds are going down. And I think out of that, you have the District 1 and 6, you know, the northern suburbs and the south-southeastern suburbs are pretty much okay with what happened with student assignment because not much changed for them. And you have kind of the west side, the traditional Black Democratic voters who tend to be strong supporters of school bonds, kind of felt like they got the short end of the stick on reassignment. On the other hand, CMS had this bond package that they had presented to county commissioners, and it was more around $800 million. And after pressure from a lot of folks, most prominently District 2 County Commissioner Vilma Leek, they decided to add West Charlotte High School and Bruns Academy. Instead of doing minor repairs, they're going to build whole new schools for those facilities. So they've sort of gotten a big incentive with the bond package as it stands now. Whether that will win them over or whether the student assignment, the sense that, you know, you didn't do right by us once again, there is a sense that the history has been that these same neighborhoods always end up not really getting an equal education. And then again, add into the mix that once this bond campaign begins, it will not be Ann Clark or it will not be sort of one of these dazzling, you know, politician superintendents like Peter Gorman or Heath Morrison. It will be the relatively unknown Clayton Wilcox, who's sort of been sitting on the sidelines at these meetings. He says he's doing this to respect Ann Clark, who finishes out on the 30th of this month. And he's a big unknown. Will he sort of have that leadership to make people feel good about CMS? Because realistically, people don't analyze. I wish they would. You know, we have to cover all the intricacies of how the money is spent and how it will play out. People vote on whether they feel good about CMS or not.
Well, and there was that talk among some folks that they might not vote for the bonds because they didn't get what they want. You just mentioned that. But let's remember that the student reassignment plan affects only a small percentage.
5%.
5% of the students in the district. So 95% of the people in the district have no immediate personal reason to attack these bonds. And so, you know, in general, I think the weight is on the other side.
Ann mentioned the sidelines, and Nick is going to want me to use that as a pun for Major League Soccer, so I will honor that request.
Ding!
There you go. So part of this county budget includes $118 million, give or take, for a new soccer stadium that would replace Memorial Stadium in Grady Cole. And we heard a little more noise this week about whether this is a good idea. So I'll start with Sean Flynn. What do you think the prospects are for the MLS stadium, which, of course, lacks a tenant at the moment?
There is so much to this story and so many different angles that we could kick around that.
Boy. Boy.
I can do this all day. No. So you obviously, the city's still not on board with this. There's very little movement. We obviously, Eric, you followed this closely. Earlier this week, a writer who follows MLS stadiums and all this ranked the 12 cities And he gave 15-1 odds that Charlotte would actually get one of these four franchises. I said, let's say hypothetically that the stadium deal all comes together. The city of Charlotte signs on to it. We build the stadium. Everything's happy, and we're unified in our goal to
score. Did you see what he did there, Nick?
To score this franchise. I can keep going. But even this writer said, even if that all comes together, we would then be, you know, in the top six, but they're still only selecting four. So even if we do everything that MLS wants, there's still a good chance that the city won't get this MLS franchise. As far as Mecklenburg County, they have to do something with Grady Cole and Memorial Stadium. They are going to have to dump millions of dollars into this facility.
There was a plan for this.
Yeah, absolutely. There's, and every few years, there's always a new plan for how they're going to spend the millions of dollars to renovate this. So however much they are spending, whether it's MLS or not, they're going to have to spend the money. As far as the city and people saying, well, I'd rather have this money for schools, they weren't even talking about taking school money. Oh, well, of course, the city doesn't have anything to do with schools, but you know, you could argue the police angle, but the money that they were talking about was coming from tourism dollars, right. So that wouldn't have any impact at all. So there's a lot of people who are saying a lot of things right now. The one person who's not saying anything is Marcus Smith.
Well, and the Observer had an editorial this week saying, quote, should Mecklenburg be nickel and diming schools while shoveling out money for a new sports facility? So what I wonder about there, and as you hear some of the talk around town, is whether that pressure will make county commissioners think twice about the decision they made in January.
Well, certainly a bad look, right? I mean, even if the pots of money are totally separate, it's always easy to make that argument. So if I'm sitting on the county commission, I'm wondering, is it really worth doing this to incur the wrath of these headlines for the next however long?
Well, and it's also hard to say they're nickel and diming when they're proposing a nearly billion-dollar bond for school construction, but
well, and James Mitchell, who's on the city council, was telling me this week that from the city perspective, they don't really have much chance of reconsidering until after the election, because, of course, in July they'll be filing, and who wants to go out and campaign on giving public money to another pro sports venue?
It was a swift and clear blow to this bid when the city council said, no, we're just not going to mess with it. I think that underscores that they were caught off guard by this when it came up. You know, I don't think that they were really prepared to make the kind of decision that they had to make when they were asked to make it. Which, if that's how you're getting off, if that's how you're starting, I don't know that that's going to bode well for you going forward.
But I think that the Smiths are thinking we're not going to get the two franchises that are one of the two franchises awarded this time around. I mean, that's pretty much going to Sacramento and one of the other top cities. I think their hope is that the election comes around, different council may be on board. There's a bigger appetite for it. Maybe they can get one of the two franchises that's going to be awarded late the following year.
Only problem, of course, is that the $150 million fee will probably be going up. But yeah, then again, they
double maybe.
They're a family of means, so maybe that can be worked out. I'm wondering, anybody else, it surprised me a little bit that the county budget included $65 million for a new main library. And it was only, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years ago that libraries were being shut left and right. And obviously, no one was supporting shutting libraries, but that's quite a stark contrast. I mean, this really didn't even seem to be much of a debate. They just said, okay.
You know, there is strong support for the library in Mecklenburg County. If you remember, 6, 7, 8 years ago when the library system was in trouble, there wasn't enough money in the budget to support everything they were doing. They talked about a wave of branch closures in the smaller branches in the towns and that sort of thing. And people came out of the woodwork to oppose that, and they had to come up with a kind of a plan B on that. And, you know, they were fundraising campaigns to save libraries like the one in Davidson. And, you know, I think that support for libraries still remains here.
That is the voice of David Borex. We're on the weekly news roundup here on Charlotte Talks, and we will be back in just a minute to talk about sunshine.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and South State Bank, committed to bridging the gap between a big bank and a small one, offering commercial banking, private banking, and wealth management. Details at southstatebank.com. And from Duke Energy, investing in technology designed to modernize the Carolinas energy grid over the next 10 years. More information at duke-energy.com/future. More analysis of the president's decision to exit the Paris Climate Accord. The Russia investigation turns up a back channel between the president's son-in-law and the Kremlin.
rumblings of a staff shakeup at the White House, including the departure this week of the White House communications director, and a deadly bombing in Kabul. Those are some of the stories they'll be looking at during the national and international news roundtable on Point following Charlotte Talks from 10 to noon. More of the local news roundup coming up in a moment here on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It is so easy to get buried underneath daily headlines and to miss the nuance of what's going on and why.
You would not fund a top Trump priority.
Job growth remains solid, wages are rising, and
kind of the status quo establishment.
With each story, we take the time to ask another question, to give you the background, to make sure you know the answer to why. Listen every day.
At 90.7 WFAE and at WFAE.org.
We're back on Charlotte Talks with the News Roundup. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. Mike is squawking this week, if no one is aware of that. Charlotte squawks. We have our distinguished panel with us. Ann Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer, Nick Oxner from WBTV, Sean Flynn from Spectrum News, and David Borex of WFAE.
Where are we?
What station am I? Is it 90?
All over the walls there.
90.7.
You've been getting Nick Oxner right. So
I did.
You're doing better.
Yeah, the Mike Collins. Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you very much. So, Nick, as we have mentioned on this program many times before, you are a devotee of public records requests and transparency. We have a couple of stories that are related
even if no
to
one in government is.
And well, one of them is your own story, which is you've been in a little bit of a back and forth trying to obtain some records from UNC Chapel Hill. What's going on there?
And at minutes before we started this conversation, I just got a new email from UNC Chapel Hill. So my blood pressure is through the roof at the moment as we talk about this. So we're working on – I made a request of a professor at the UNC School of Government for an email exchange that that professor had with Trey Robison, the district attorney in Union County, for a story that we're working on that we reported this week as well. So I made the request. The professor said, yeah, we should be able to give you – as for just a string of emails. It ended up being 4 pages of emails. He said, yeah, we should be able to give that to you, no problem, but I've got to send it to my record – you know, our records office, and they'll get back to you. And they should be able to give you the records. Well, the UNC Chapel Hill records office came back and said that they would not give me any of the responsive records, and they cited an exempt part of the law that says that law enforcement records of criminal investigations are exempt from public disclosure. Now, the problem with them citing that exemption is that the exemption only applies to law enforcement agencies. So in order for that exemption to apply, they're essentially saying that the UNC School of Government is a public law enforcement agency because it can only apply to them. And they stuck with that position and stuck with that position until last – well, and actually they still maintain that until finally a couple days after we did our first story about it, they decided, well, maybe we should give him the records.
And, you know, transparency, sunshine laws, those obviously come up in all of our jobs a lot. The reason I wanted to talk about that story in particular is because, to me, it plays off of what we discussed a little bit last week, which is this idea – not idea, this decision by city council to no longer televise one of the citizens' forums each month. So I'm wondering, Nick, you covered Marcus Jones, the city manager in Norfolk. Do you think he had much of a say in that policy?
Yeah, I mean, my time covering Marcus Jones in Norfolk it was 2 years, and I never met the guy. And he was not a I say that to illustrate that he was not a public figure and not someone out front. And I think that Marcus Jones is about the swift and efficient operation of government. I do not think he views an open dialogue with the public as being an essential part of his job. And so it would not surprise me at all if he views, you know, televising the citizen comments as an important thing that the city needs to make sure the trash gets taken up on time and the police solve crimes.
So do we
this
think
is the council's decision, though.
It was a council's decision. Sure.
And they are the ones that I think we should hold accountable for this.
Oh, absolutely.
So.
Yeah.
The Charlotte Mecklenburg School Board has been having some somewhat similar discussions in their policy committee saying, yes, we value public comments, but their approach is kind of open mic at the beginning of the first meeting of every month, and you get 3 minutes or 2 minutes, depending on where they set it, to just come and talk about anything. And those meetings have not been as raucous as some of these city council meetings that have gotten really, you know, led to meetings being closed, but they have been long, they have been passionate, and the school board members are now saying, well, we think what people ought to be seeing on TV is us doing the business of the public as opposed to an nearly sometimes unending stream of public comments about whatever is on their mind. So
criticizing them, of course.
Well, that yeah. sometimes does happen, yes. So there's been talk about, do we somehow reconfigure, not eliminate public comments, but do it in a way that less of our TV time is devoted
and
to
And they
it.
Haven't eliminated them. They're still going
right.
to have these
They're
meetings twice a month,
That's
and
right.
they just won't be on TV.
I think some of the pushback is that people, obviously, when they have a chance to go on television, might start grandstanding, and so that is part of
I've
the
argument. I've never experienced that.
Yeah, no. No one here, of course.
But let's remember, when we first started televising public meetings, the elected officials started to figure out how to use them. And it's no surprise that the public is now starting to think about
and
that as well.
And the public officials still do. I mean, you get to that at the end of the school board meetings when there are board reports and everybody's ready to go home. And somebody decides they're going to deliver a 3-minute public service announcement about their favorite cause, you know, and clearly looking to the TV cameras because there's nobody left in the chambers.
That sounds like someone who's covered a lot of public meetings, doesn't it?
Not that I'm ever eager to go home. I love every minute.
So, Sean, do you think something is lost by not having, for example, a citizens forum on every month? Does that matter?
Personally, I think every single part of every single public meeting should be broadcast. That way, anyone who cannot go to these meetings can absolutely see what is going on in it, the good, the bad, the ugly. I mean, the thought that a TV camera is making people grandstand, that's not what making people grandstand. I think what you're seeing is a room full of people, and they're grandstanding to the room full of people who, at the end of it, are cheering on what they just said. I think that's what people are grandstanding, if any grandstanding is going on. But why not? Why not just broadcast everything? I mean, it's a public meeting, so why not?
Well, and my thought was that, you know, it's not like the government channel is competing with Hulu and Netflix.
Exactly. I mean, look, open this society and democracy was founded on openness and transparency in government, right? The federal government, the state government, the school board, everything. And an open meeting is an open meeting, to Sean's point. And, you know, the open meeting law apply and you know, you don't violate the open meetings law by not televising the public comment section. But, you know, the entire part of it is a meeting. So why would we not televise it? It just doesn't make
sense. In this era when people don't trust the media to filter the message, I think it's great that, you know, it used to be that if a school board member said, Ann Helms totally misrepresented this quote out of the context of this, it was that person against my interpretation. Now, anybody who wants to can go, and I actually like that people.
That's
can
an
go
interesting point. You've got the backup,
and it's readily there to stream on archive online. You don't have to show up to the meeting to know all of what was said. You just have to take the time and go on your laptop and watch it.
You know, the public
are our body cameras. These are our journalist body cameras.
You know, the public.
Well, in that case, you'll never see the video. It's actually not public.
I didn't mean to interrupt you.
The public comment section of the meeting is just as much a part of the process as the business part of the meeting. And, you know, you've been to these meetings. People get organized. They bring a crowd. They bring signs. They get a list of speakers, and they have each speaker say different points. And when a group of people get together to make a point about something, I think that's an important thing to watch. And, you know, we need to pay attention to that.
Well, and I think the other part that is important here is everyone doesn't have the time or the means maybe to go to a public meeting. And so that's part of the way you get information about issues.
How do you know what people are talking about? I mean, one of the best points we have right now is the Extraordinary Events Ordinance. There have been people at city council meetings for the past couple of years. Every meeting, somebody will make a statement about it, sometimes several people. And what's happened now is the city is reconsidering that.
Good point. Speaking of people being upset, Anne, I want to ask you about a story that you didn't do but that was in the Observer, which is it's pool season.
Yes.
And apparently the county's had a little trouble getting all of the pools inspected on time. I'm engaging in hyperbole here. So
understatement.
Or understatement. I'm sorry, understatement, not hyperbole. Help me with my – I'm a man of words.
They're
apparently
having trouble getting them inspected. Forget
yes,
the on time.
Yeah, they're just not doing it. So I'm wondering, what sense do you get of reaction to this story? Because I would think this would get a lot of people's attention, particularly parents.
Yeah, and I don't know, and this was done by Anna Douglas, who is a very new reporter at the Charlotte Observer, so yay, we're actually hiring people, and they're really good. And she just decided, it's pool time, let's look at the inspection records, let's see what's there, and she found not only were there huge numbers that were opening without a pre-inspection, which in some ways is not that surprising, because you got to figure there's a very small window of the pool is up and ready versus, you know, it opens on Memorial Day weekend. So some of them are going to get inspected later. But what I think really surprised her was when she found that there were ones that last year had their permits revoked for very significant violations, And they had not had a follow-up inspection. We were just apparently kind of trusting that they fixed it. And so that seems like a huge gap. And what the county has said is that, you know, they're in there, they're coded as permit suspended. Then the end of the year comes, and everybody just gets coded as closed for the season, and we're not flagging them as we should be. So there's been, on the staff, some sense of, oh, yeah, we need to do this better, but not a lot of urgency from the county commissioners, who I think are hearing from the public. There's a lot of urgency, and there's a sense that, you know, this isn't the first time we've been dealing with some pretty significant complaints about the health department. And again, this is not the Charlotte Observer out to get Marcus Plescia. This is a totally new reporter just checking a matter of public interest. And again, you have your employees sort of trying to defend breakdowns in the system that really shouldn't be there.
Well, I mean, I know it's an obvious point, but that's what I was going to mention is, my goodness, the health department, you know, they are still dealing with all of the other issues, taking care or not alerting the female patients about test results, very serious matters, and now here comes this.
Well, this goes back to a discussion that I know has been kind of simmering below the surface for some time now, is that Marcus Plescia came into this job and wanted to do a lot of aggressive things, you know, community gardens and kind of help shape health policy and how we approach this. But before you do that, you got to get the fundamentals of your job down, right? You got to get the test results and you got to inspect the pools. And I think you know, maybe the leadership at the health department has overreached a little bit and kind of fallen short on some of the fundamentals.
I was just going to add on to this. This story is personally ironic to me because the day before this article came out, the health department shut down my pool I go to.
Really? Because you're the one.
You may have been one of the ones when they were scrambling to try to fix some things before the story came out.
It was a filter issue, which was fixed within hours, but there was a little bit of laughter there for me.
These are the kinds of things that you don't think about as being that huge of a deal, but actually can be quite significant.
Oh, absolutely.
You know?
Especially if the filter's not on correctly. I mean, there's been cases of kids dying because of this.
Well, and I think the other thing is, these are the kinds of stories that in some ways seem mundane, but boy, they really resonate with voters.
Absolutely.
Because you don't forget when things like that go wrong. It doesn't, you know, that's not something where you just say, oh, well, that was no big deal.
And these are, you know, they're not inspecting individuals. If you have a pool in your backyard, you're not getting the health department out to inspect it. But these are basically community pools, apartment complexes, hotels, neighborhood associations, and there are about 1,400 of them in Mecklenburg County, which is a lot of work, but that's also a lot of swimmers who are believing that they have some protection.
Of course, this all came out about a week after a CDC report came out that said that there's a nasty little bug that's going into swimming pools that's causing stomach issues, and the problem's gotten twice as bad as it was the year before.
So do we think, you know, what kind of pressure do we think this is going to create on a health department that is already, to use the journalistic word, embattled?
Very conversational of you, Eric.
Yes, I had to use that word.
We're digesting that for a second.
Yeah. Pause.
It certainly doesn't help. I mean, it certainly doesn't help. And if, again, it's just another example of the health department, you know, saying, why did you guys screw this up too?
David, I wanted to ask you about extraordinary events because I think that's one that you've been covering. Maybe a little perspective for people on what that entails and what they're talking about changing.
So the Extraordinary Events Ordinance was passed in 2012 before the Democratic National Convention came to town, and the idea was to give police a few extra powers to help manage the crowds there. And it allowed them to stop people as they were going towards the venues. They could search your backpack. In some cases, you couldn't bring backpacks in. And that has been in place since 2012. And the idea originally was it would be used 3 or 4 times a year. Well, it has been used about 41 times since then, and far more than ever anticipated. And as I mentioned before, people have been coming to the city council meetings in the last couple of years making complaints about this and suggesting that it was time, we didn't need it anymore, you know, there's no DNC, and that it was not being used the way it was originally intended. And the new city manager, when he came to town, actually heard those, and he said, let's review this. And they've been doing it since January. And there was a vote scheduled 2 weeks ago on Monday night, and it was put off. The council would like to get some more feedback on this. They're going to have a public forum this coming Tuesday, and it'll be a chance for people to talk about what they like and what they don't like. The idea on the table is to repeal the existing ordinance, but to put some of those powers into other parts of the city code. So I think the question for people who are concerned about this is how much stays in.
Well, it also comes at a challenging time for opponents of the extraordinary ordinance after what happened in Manchester with all the, you know, things that are happening there. One of the primary things that the extraordinary events ordinance does is allow people, police, to check backpacks.
Right. And it's been applied, what, things like Speed Street,
St. Patrick's
Day. Gay Pride Parade, fireworks.
CIAA.
The Panthers games. I think, I don't know that the extraordinary events declaration was ever used to in any way that caused some big controversy, you know, as though it was a massive infringement on human rights or, you know, your privacy. But I think the opponents of the extraordinary events ordinance would say that it has the potential, if, you know, used the wrong way, to get out of hand, you know, to give police too much power to, you know, if you're wearing a mask, you can be stopped or like bans the wearing of.
Yeah.
So some of those things you think, really? Not that people in masks were being arrested like that, but it's just, and so I think this is, it's good. It's heartening that the city council is taking a look at this, and we'll see where they end.
Does CMPD grant that there are changes needed in this policy?
I actually think this discussion began with the chief, and and it came up to at one of the public safety committee meetings at the council, and it was suggested that they take a look at it. And so this is coming from the police as well as the public.
Yeah, I mean, that's going to be an interesting conversation given where we started this show. I mean, I know they're not related, but they are all related in a way when we have such a big concern with public safety this year. Mm-hmm. All right, there we go. Before we stop, let's see any big stories this week that anybody is following. Is it all budget, all budget, all budget?
We just did a big story about Hurricane Matthew flood relief funding that aired last night and found that there's $100 million that's been appropriated by lawmakers still sitting in the bank. So as we talk about budget, that's certainly something to look at going forward.
Absolutely. Well, I want to thank our panel. That was Nick Oxner from WBTV, who you just heard, Sean Flynn from Spectrum News, and Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer, who will not be with us for the next few weeks. So we will look forward to your return. David Borax from WFAE. I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and you have been listening to the Weekly News Roundup on Charlotte Talks.